Okay, the next item on our agenda this morning is the response from the Cultural Resources Roundtable on the Notice of Forest Practices to Affected Indian Tribes Rulemaking. Pete Heidi and Jeffrey Thomas, please come forward. And Jeffrey might be out of the room for a moment, but I'm sure he'll be back in a moment. Maybe I'll take this opportunity just to remind the board that we are in the process of rulemaking on this. The 102 is out, and we asked a very specific question to the Cultural Resources Roundtable. If you recall, at our last board meeting, we had a conversation about the particular language. I don't have it right in front of me, but essentially it was a question as to whether notification via certified letter was an and or an or. And that very last portion of the procedures for notification. And so we asked the Cultural Resources Roundtable to revisit that particular question and report back to the board if they had deliberately put and in there so that we would know. And just a reminder, we are in the rulemaking process at this time. Jeffrey, thank you for joining us. Please go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair, members of the board, my name is Peter Heidi. I'm the Director of Forest Policy for Washington Forest Protection Association, also the co-chair of the Cultural Resources Roundtable. I guess what I'll do is just, in response to the question, I just have to say that the roundtable, after quite a bit of discussion on the topic, and actually coming up with some ideas, in the end, was not able to find a consensus on recommendation. Now, there's quite a lot behind that, and I don't know how much I really want to say because we didn't sit and talk about what our report would be to the board. But I will say that first of all, there was no consensus around changing the language that was originally brought up about the and the or. There was quite a bit of concern from a number of the roundtable members that we really do need to have that certified letter when there is an actual cultural resource issue that needs to be discussed with the tribe as a result of the rule. However, we did come up with some ideas about changing some of the other language that would be very more specific about when the meeting is required. That was at the meeting in September agreed to some language change, and Norm attended that meeting. But then when we sent that language out to our constituents, you know, in the committee all represent others, and so one of the stakeholders, which was the DNR, came back and said that the language that we proposed would be actually more confusing and not necessarily appropriate for the rule. So in our October meeting, we talked about that, but we were not able to come to any consensus about changing it. And that's partly because we had not put additional discussion of this on our agenda in October because we thought we'd consulted. And so we didn't have a thorough discussion about, you know, what the concerns were from DNR and how we might be able to address that. So I don't know, Jeff, if you have any further comment there. I'm just a little afraid to go into too much detail because, you know, we didn't talk about it that much after the original recommendation did not see consensus.
So before you hand it off to Jeffrey, let me just make sure I understood what you said, and that we asked you if there was consensus amongst the roundtable, which brought a consensus recommendation to us initially. Mm-hmm. We asked if there was consensus in changing that from and to or, and you're reporting back that there was no consensus to change that.
Yeah, it was clear that we could not get consensus to change that.
Okay, thank you. Jeffrey, did you want to add anything to that?
You betcha. I have spent a lot of time with the roundtable group, previously known as the Cultural Resources Committee, and I'm always hesitant to report to the board myself or on behalf of the Title TFW program, that consent, we were unable to arrive at consensus about an issue. My interpretation, which is maybe the other side of the coin from the one that Pete's just shared, is that we were in consensus that we wouldn't change anything right now. And so there may not have been consensus about potential change to the original recommendation, but at this point, nobody was pushing for a particular change to be affected compared to what is currently under CR-102. So I'm not sure how you want to take that.
So I guess I would take it that we asked the particular question and we got an answer, that there is not a consensus to change what is currently out for public comments. And we have hearings scheduled in January, and you mentioned earlier about concern about appropriate dissemination of the information, which we will address. My preference at this point would be that we allow the rulemaking process to continue. We will certainly have, we will certainly receive comments and hear testimony at our hearings. And if there are individuals that wish to propose alternative language, that they will do so through our normal rulemaking approach.
So I'm sorry, but I guess my view is that without anybody advocating for a change in the rule language we had originally submitted, there's consensus that we don't want to change anything yet.
I agree.
I think that's an important point. Something else is, in the conversation that occurred during September, the modification of the term involved, of the term involves, as it pertains to FPAs and cultural resources and when the meeting requirement might be triggered. It's in the new rule language being proposed to be altered to contains, has maybe generated additional questions about what either of them might mean. For example, not sure what contains means, or not sure how contains is determined. And so, with that being the case, a potential fix about when the meeting is triggered that might include language involving things like when a cultural resource is identified, again, brings up questions identified by how. And some of that was what was considered to be a potential concern by DNR forest practices, how just what the right terminology was and how it would be implemented and utilized in this such. So again, involves, contains, identified, those are all key terms that when used may need greater clarity as to what they mean and when they apply.
Well, thank you for pointing those out to us, and I would hope that you or other members of the roundtable or all stakeholders feel free to provide comments to the board during our written comment period, as well as through testimony at our public hearings. Great. Yes, Norm.
I wanted to thank the roundtable for giving me the opportunity to come and talk with them about the issue that I did raise, whether it was an and or an or and. Really, we had a very good discussion at the roundtable. And there was considerable effort. I guess it was probably an hour-long discussion or something in that regard that really worked hard to come up with a solution for the problem that I brought forward. And unfortunately, that solution didn't achieve full consensus after some further deliberation and stakeholder review. But I do appreciate having that concern heard. I still have the concern. because it, I don't believe it was fully addressed in the original real proposal or in the, maybe even in the suggested change that, that went out for stakeholder review. So that may be something that will yet come, and I don't know if the roundtable has any appetite or interest in continuing to try to find something that would be workable to address that. I would be happy to continue working with you if that is of interest, but I know that you've got other things to do and limited time. So I'll have to leave it to roundtable's discretion. If they want to continue to work on that, I'm happy to continue to try to do so as well. And but I do thank you for making a very good faith effort.
Thank you, Art. Other comments from board members on this rulemaking? No. Okay. Thank you both for taking that question back to the roundtable and reporting back. We genuinely appreciate that. Your comments. Okay. The I want to just take a moment and back up on the agenda for a moment. It's come to my attention that the item that we talked about earlier, the Northern Spotted Owl Conservation Advisory Group, where we had the presentation from Mark that there was the group was not convened, etc. The rule actually states that on an annual basis, not only are they to report to us, but the board will determine whether this group's function continues to be needed for spotted owl conservation. And we neglected to do so. So at this point, that group has not convened once. I am of the opinion that we just continue to leave the group in place so that we have that mechanism should we need it. But we don't have an agenda, an action item queued up for an agenda on this. So I wanted to just give the board an opportunity if anybody on the board felt that there was a need to revisit whether that group should remain in effect or not.
No.
No, okay. All right, so noted. Okay, thank you. Next item on our agenda is the public comment on our critical habitat rulemaking. This is the rulemaking regarding bald eagles, etc. And we have one member of the public signed up, and that's Carl Whitaker. Please come forward, Carl. Hello again.
Thank you. Hello again. Since your last meeting, the Conservation Caucus has been working closely with DNR and DFW staff and other stakeholders in the Wildlife Work Group to identify solutions for maintaining protection of bald eagles under the Federal Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act in the absence of state critical habitat for eagles. We are satisfied that the administrative actions outlined in DFW's recent memo in your board packet and those proposed by the Fish and Wildlife Service to better implement the Federal Eagle Act guidelines will be sufficient for minimizing the take of eagles due to forest practices. We'd like to thank DNR and DFW staff for facilitating open communication on this topic, for addressing our concerns, and for committing to cooperate with the Fish and Wildlife Service to protect eagles. Our caucus is also happy to provide assistance to the agencies as they put these new administrative actions in place. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. Any questions? Progress. Yes. Okay, the next item on our agenda is a presentation by David Whipple and Jim Michaels from the State and Federal Fish and Wildlife Services, respectively, on the Wildlife Working Group's recommendations on bald eagles. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. And Chair, members of the Board, I'm David Whipple, Forest Policy Coordinator for Department of Fish and Wildlife.
And I'm Jim Michaels. I'm the Division Manager for HCPs and Hydropower Management.
So what we'd like to do today is report back on the work that we did between the last board meeting and today. And Jim's here to help explain some of the federal side of this equation. So kind of going back for a moment, in August at the board meeting, the board initiated rulemaking to modify the critical habitat rule for, among other species, the bald eagle. And that was based on the Fish and Wildlife Commission action, of course. And also in August, the board had a discussion about how landowners can be directed to the Fish and Wildlife Service in terms of implementing the Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act. And during that discussion, there was talk of possible either regulatory or additional administrative avenues to make sure that the loop was closed, so to speak, between landowners, the state process in terms of the forest practices applications, and then the federal Bald Eagle Act. And so I was tasked with convening the Wildlife Work Group to discuss possible rural avenues and administrative avenues to kind of close that gap and resolve the outstanding issues. So the work group met a couple times, twice, to discuss those options. And no news in terms of kind of what we discussed from the August presentation, but I'll quickly review those. We did talk about two possible rural avenues, one being the Class 4 Special Forest Practices applications. That's a place in the rules where unstable slopes reside and some other automatic Class 4 Special Forest Practices application designations lies. And in that particular rural situation, FPAs would, the FPAs that are captured by that rule represent a potential for significant adverse impact to the environment. And in implementing that rule, DNR would be needing to make a threshold determination on those forest practices applications. In other words, they would have to be deciding on whether or not the proposed FPA would be a probable significant adverse impact. So there was a question, well, in addition to those specific elements in that particular rule, there is a subsection in that rule that basically says all those rules specific to threatened and endangered species in 16080, which is the critical wildlife habitat state rule, are automatic SEPA triggers. So it kind of subsumes the critical habitat list of species, which is intended for listed species. So there was a question really on whether or not that rule is an appropriate mechanism for this species, knowing that it is downlisted and delisted, etc. So there wasn't a lot of discussion around that, but let me go on and I'll kind of explain a couple other things in terms of the rule avenues. The second option for a rule that was discussed was kind of a standard rule, similar to riparian zones and wetland management zones, et cetera. And that's kind of a no harvest approach, as in, you know, you have to leave so many snags or you have to leave the core zone of the RMZ, et cetera. And, but like those other rules, alternate plans are always an option for a landowner that wants to propose one and meet the same level of protection that the rules provide, but in a different way. So some of the issues for both of those rule mechanisms are, in addition to the ones that I outlined for the Class 4 Special Trigger, a couple other ones are that both regulatory options would be presenting DNR and DFW with a relatively significant workload at a time when DFW has deferred bald eagle protection to the Fish and Wildlife Service due to the Commission's actions. And just as importantly, if you kind of go down either one of those rural roads, you wind up in a situation possibly where landowners either propose an alternate plan via a standard rule, or DNR would be approving an app under a standard rule or the Class 4 Special Trigger rule that where the FPA would be proposing to do things differently than the federal guidelines propose. And in addition to that, the federal guidelines and the Bald Eagle Protection Act have a cap on the allowable take that Fish and Wildlife Service is going to allow on a regional basis year by year. So DNR could be in the position of approving an application that deviates from the federal guidelines and also maybe exceeds that cap on take. So you have conflicting federal and state rules and guidelines and implementation mechanisms, which quickly gets fairly messy. So we focused really on additional administrative options that would close the loop instead of a rule. And a lot of those we had already committed to, and I'll quickly run through those. And these are ones that we discussed at the August meeting, one being DFW.
Are these listed in your memo?
They are.
The bulleted items?
Yeah. Are there any, maybe I, in the interest of time, Madam Chair, I don't know if you want me to go
We're
through
those. We're a little out of schedule, so it's okay to go through them.
Okay. I'll do it briefly. DFW still is going to review forest practices applications for a lot of species, eagles included. And when an FPA is within 660 feet, which is the way that I understand it, the maximum extent of the bald eagle protection guidelines from the Fish and Wildlife Service. If there's an FPA within there, we would be notifying the landowner based on the information in the FPA. And we also send a copy or a notification to Fish and Wildlife Service so they know what's going on. Landowners and tribes can obtain the actual bald eagle data and database locations directly. Landowners can have all of that data for their individual ownerships, and the tribes can request the bald eagle data for statewide if they would like, or within their area of interest. So they can have the actual data. Landowners as those proposing forest practice applications, and tribes as a way of not only proposing forest practices, but also those tribes that are interested in working with landowners to make sure protection is achieved. Which then there's, for the rest of the FPA reviewers, there's also an FPARS profile that they can achieve through DNR, which gives them notification of forest practice applications within an area of interest that are within or potentially within that 660 feet as well. And then all parties have available to them the PHS on the web, which is DFW's database for a lot of different species and habitats, and it's on a web-based application now where anybody can go in and take a look at what's around as far as priority habitats and species on any piece of ground in the state. So there are ways to review potential effects or impacts from forest practice applications. So there are three significant new administrative options that we had agreed to over the course of our last two meetings. One of which DNR agreed to put a checkbox on what's called the FPA office checklist. And this is a checklist that the office, forest practices office staff in the regions can check if the FPA is actually within 660 feet. So they screen apps for all kinds of natural resource issues, bald eagles being one of them. If the FPA appears that it could be within 660 feet, they'll check this box on the front of it on the checklist, and that will be scanned into FPARS so that anybody that reviews that particular forest practices application according to their profile that they set up in DNR, they'll plainly and clearly and quickly see that if there's a potential conflict there. They can work with the landowner if they so choose. The landowner will basically have a heads up that they have an eagle issue if they didn't know about it already. And then the other thing was on that checkbox, there'll also be some comments relative to please see DFW's fact sheet that we're going to be putting together for more information. And so that's kind of another way to close the loop. That fact sheet will be, it looks, we have something out, and I didn't hand this out because it's really relative to our PHS management recommendations as they as the counties use them. But it's going to look something similar with a lot of good information about what the rule changes are, what it means to landowners, frequently asked questions about how they find out information, where the nest sites are, how they get a hold of Fish and Wildlife Service, and that whole process. So that's in the works. That FPA or fact sheet will be mailed by DNR to the landowners along with their FPA approval sheet, and I understand that's a common practice that happens with all apps right now. So the landowners, if they hadn't known about it already, they'll get this fact sheet in the mail with their FPA approval sheet if they're within 660 feet of an eagle site. The other thing that DNR is going to do is put a link to the PHS on the web, our website. They're going to put a link to our website on their FPARS webpage. And that's a place where all landowners go to get their activity map and other information about forest practices applications, download the app, etc. So there's going to be multiple places where landowners can become aware, if they don't know already, that they may have an eagle issue. And all of this is really intended to create awareness, both in terms of the landowners and also those folks that want to review apps like they do now for anything else. So I think we've closed the loop pretty well, and we're still working with the Fish and Wildlife Service on other administrative things relative to their process. But taken together, number one, kind of the concerns and issues about a regulatory avenue and the specific issues that those avenues would present, along with this list of roughly 9 administrative options that the state agencies, along with collaboration with the stakeholders and Fish and Wildlife Service, are going to do, got us basically to a consensus within the Wildlife Work Group that no additional rulemaking would be needed at this time for bald eagles. So that's really the take-home message that we were charged to investigate, and I'm pleased to report that was the outcome of our meetings. So maybe we can pause for questions if we like, or we can turn it over to Fish and Wildlife Service.
Yeah, let's pause for a question there. Any questions regarding the Wildlife Work Group process and their report back to us and their recommendation? Yes, Nora.
Dave, just to be clear, I think that the rule proposal is then that the bald eagle, as well as some others, would be removed from the critical habitat list within rule, and that is your consensus and agreement from the Wildlife Working Group.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. That, as you know, is moving forward through the board process and has been initiated. I was, and that there is no objection to that moving forward. In addition to that, we were charged to look to investigate other potential rule options. So, in other words, it could pertain to the current rulemaking or additional rulemaking and additional administrative options. And so, basically, the work group is in agreement that the current rulemaking should move forward and that no other rules should be pursued relative to bald eagles.
A couple of other follow-ups. These are under points that you had laid out. If I read correctly and understand the federal guidelines, it is specifically referring to nesting locations, active and maybe inactive. I can't remember if that's the case. That, you know, maybe not active this year, but were active sometime recently. But I think that the information that may be in FPARS is a broader definition of where eagles are known to be utilizing lands, in other words, roosting and some of the other functions that are out there. So there may, I'm not sure if there's still a conflict or if the list, the PHS list, would be edited in some fashion, so that it would be reflective of the nesting locations, so it's consistent with the federal guidelines?
There are a few points to be made there, and you're right in that PHS right now. Number one, the distances in the PHS database have been shrunk down to 660 feet to be consistent with the federal guidelines. They do still contain roost sites, and roost sites are important, and I'm going to let Jim Michaels talk about how the Eagle Act protects roost sites. I believe it still does, but I'm going to let him address that. So there's also the topic of current versus maybe not current in the current year nesting sites in bald eagles, because they come back maybe not necessarily every year, but within the foreseeable future, 1 to 3 years or 5 years or whatever it is, that all those nests are still protected, but there are reporting mechanisms in place, and we'll make that clear in the fact sheet, that landowners can report either new nests or nest sites that have essentially blown down and can no longer be active. So there are those mechanisms in place to have that interaction.
Okay. I have another follow-up, but I'll wait until after.
Maybe just for clarity, though, your question in particular was, will the sizes of the area be consistent from the PHS to DNR screening tool? And the answer is yes. Okay, Jim.
Well, thank the board for having me here today. And we've been working with DNR and the Department of Fish and Wildlife on this issue, and I really appreciate their efforts to try to look out for bald eagles. And now that we have a responsibility, we do have a small staff involved with trying to address all of the bald eagles in the state, which are quite a few, including urban eagles and as well as FPA. The FPAs are probably the easier one to grapple with, as far as, you know, working with landowners. You're dealing with timber folks that are out there, and they already know the situations. So they sort of know the rules, and these rules are actually more condensed than what the Forest Practice Board had put together. The service does support the administrative approach. We think it's probably the appropriate way to go. We are looking at trying to make this as easy as possible, given the current situation in budgets and staffing levels. And so we'd like to also make it very easy for landowners, too. So we're developing a self-certifying document that the landowners can sign. And basically, it just has the information that if you're going to be staying out of if you've got a timber sale that's adjacent to a bald eagle nest site or a roost site, that you stay outside of 660 feet during the breeding season, and that there can be some harvest of timber within that first 330 feet outside, but that's outside the breeding season, and you have to leave an overstory cover around that. We will have staff available to provide technical assistance if there's any other kind of situation that comes up that doesn't meet the guidelines, or if you have questions about filling out the self-certifying document. We'll be working with both state agencies in the development of the pamphlet, and it'll have more information. It'll have links there to go back and look at our regulations and also our guidelines, and a little bit about the permit system. We can issue permits, and like David said, they're very limited. So we try to work with landowners to do technical assistance to try to get conservation measures so we don't have to issue permits, because there is a cap on those. There's two more things I think I just want to say. We'd like to see the board consider making the bald eagle self-certification a condition of the permit, that if a landowner does have a situation that he can at least testify that, yeah, we understand the regulations, the guidelines, we understand that if I work within this order of conditions, that I don't need a permit, and then I can travel forward with that. And so I'll just put that on the table, that we would like to see that as a condition of the permit. And the other thing is, we want to make sure that the landowners are covered, so they're not left hanging out here, having a law enforcement investigation on their part because of misunderstanding. And that's why we're trying our best to get technical assistance out there, phone numbers and everything, so that you can reach my staff. And we also are concerned about, because we also implement the habitat conservation plan, we're concerned about the integrity of the plan. And so we don't want to see a federal violation happen by accident because a landowner got misinformation, or the state overlooked the actual process. I'll answer any questions.
I think I'll start.
Okay.
So I'm a little confused. What I thought I heard you say at the beginning was you are supportive of the administrative option.
Yes.
And then I heard you say that you wish to see the guidelines as a condition of the application, which would require a completely different approach.
That would be in addition to what was put on the table, yes.
Okay, so are you satisfied with the administrative approach that is being proposed? Because the board is going to contemplate next moving to the next step of our rulemaking process to not include additional regulations, but rather going the administrative route.
I understand. That is a request from the service. We'd like to see you do that.
So you're not supportive of the administrative approach?
Well, to the point that everything is in here, yes, I do, but I would like to see the other addition.
Appreciate your clarity on that. Okay, questions?
Going back to the my previous round of questions regarding roost sites, nest sites, and so on. Previously, before this change in rule, whenever we would have a particular incident with eagle location, we would have WDFW staff that we would contact, make a bald eagle management plan if necessary, which would then become part of our approved FPA. And so that was our avenue for working out any particular issues that existed around a given site. In the absence of that particular opportunity, what will be our best way of bringing that forward now? Is it still an interaction with State Department of Fish and Wildlife, or is it through U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service? And what if we find, and maybe this more particularly, data that's in the system that we know and actually U.S. or WDFW knows to be an error, but still hasn't been fixed?
Well, in the past, we've, as everyone knows, have written bald eagle management plans for those sites, and we are no longer doing that. Fish and Wildlife Commission modified our rule such that our rules are no longer in effect unless the species is listed in the future. So right now, as of today, we no longer write bald eagle management plans. Therefore, we're relying on the administrative options and the avenues that we've committed to, and in addition, steering landowners to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in terms of protection and compliance and consistency with the Bald Eagle Act. So that's the current process. We don't have the staff any longer to write bald eagle plans. So instead of coming to us, everybody's going to be going to the Fish and Wildlife Service.
And who will maintain the database then that will be triggering the notification within Forest Practices Program?
DFW will still maintain the Bald Eagle database because the Fish and Wildlife Service doesn't have one, and they rely on us to maintain that database. And we will be doing so in conjunction with information from landowners and Fish and Wildlife Service relative to active nest sites or nest sites that are no longer there, or we will be making adjustments as we go all along. And that doesn't preclude in the case where a landowner goes out to try to, let's just say, for instance, stay outside that 660-foot distance or 330-foot, and they don't find the nest. Or they see remnants of where the nest was because they know the property, and or it's just no longer there. Then there are mechanisms where we can talk, and we can talk with the federal services to get that information updated in the system.
Okay, so our first point of contact then is with in terms of WDFW in that regard, and you will communicate with U.S. Fish and Wildlife.
You know, in terms of updating the database and changes to the database, I think it's going to be all three parties, because we're going to maintain the database, yet Fish and Wildlife Service is in charge of implementing the Bald Eagle Legal Protection Act, and the landowner is responsible to comply with that, federal law, etc. So it'll be a three-way communication to make sure that we're all on the same page and we have all the latest information and the correct information.
Question for you, Jim. Did the original delisting of the eagle include a post-delisting monitoring period?
Yes, it did.
And is that monitoring period still in effect?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes.
And is the information that you'll be gathering sort of this administrative linkage play into that?
It will, yes. Okay. And we'll consider all of that. Plus, we're providing funding for the state to actually do surveys. You get an idea of what the population is doing.
Thanks for coming today, Jim. Appreciate it. I guess similar to the chair, I'm a little bit confused and frankly concerned at this point that the services are asking for the self-certification process to be a condition of the FPA. I don't know if you can or if you're willing to elaborate a little further on why we're hearing about that at this stage. There has been a lot of time and effort put into trying to figure out how to move forward. And if there's any opportunity to basically to satisfy the services needs without doing that, just because I'm trying to anticipate how we can grapple with that as a board.
It was another safeguard that we were looking at closing the loop, at least with the DNR folks, so that we don't have any flybys. One of the things that I know we've talked with wildlife, and I'm not sure if we talked about the soft certification, but we didn't talk about the conditioning. And so that is something that we've been talking about the last few days. We were trying to have another meeting with DNR, and unfortunately we didn't have that. So it's sort of a surprise to you, I realize. But it's more of a stopgap to protect the HCP, the integrity of the HCP, in that you do have a federal permit for take. Bald eagles are not covered under that take permit. But it is a federal action, or it's a federal law that cannot be violated either. And so we're just requesting that the board look at that and consider including that as part of the process.
So, Jim, I'd like to ask you to clarify, maybe for the board, what the nexus between our forest and fish habitat conservation plan is. That could I hear you saying that there's some threat to our HCP from this, and I just want to make sure all the board members thoroughly understand your perspective on that linkage.
Right. It's all part of a third-party lawsuit. If somebody comes up and says, "Hey, you didn't do this," and we had a bald eagle nest taken down, you basically could be pulled into court over that. Now, whether or not you'd be culpable, I mean, that's for the law to figure out. But that is one of the things that we're concerned about. Also, that it's maintaining the integrity of the HCP, and I've said that before. But what I'm looking at is, you know, we actually did a Section 7 that considered all the impacts to spotted owls, bald eagles, mottled murrelets, other listed species besides aquatic species that you receive to cover for. So even in an omission, if you have a situation where you are in violation or at least not complying with the fall of the Golden Eagle Protection Act, there is a possibility there that there could be a risk to the state in their HCP.
So I just want to go a little further, and I know there are other board members that have questions. So what I believe I'm hearing is that if a landowner does not comply with the guidelines and there is a third-party litigation to that effect, that there is somehow a nexus to our HCP that does not include eagles.
That, yes, that's our interpretation.
I think the board might beg to differ, but other questions? So it's the general principle that in order to maintain the permit under your HCP, you have to be in compliance with all federal laws.
Right. That's it.
So that's great. Well, that was just clarifying. Right.
Though. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm not certain it's this board's obligation to comply all federal rules, but nonetheless, I'm sure that a rich dialogue could occur on that one. Okay. Other questions for our Fish and Wildlife?
This is a new item, and we're in the middle of a rulemaking process. I'm wondering if there might be the opportunity either during lunch at this meeting, or I'm not quite sure of the timeline for finalizing the rule, but if there would be model language or a proposal for us to consider. So you've given a verbal proposal, but how would that actually work? So it might be a question for staff, like how would we satisfy this request? What would the language look like? What would it look like for you as staff to implement it? And so I don't know if there's time in the context of this meeting to have a discussion, or to do that, or prefer to take it to the next meeting, but just in order to not completely ignore your discussion or your request, I mean, how is it that we would procedurally be able to address it?
So the next item on our agenda is our rulemaking, and we have a full agenda for the afternoon, and so I don't believe I have the staff capacity at this point to sort of to go write draft rule language at this moment, and so it would be my prerogative, and I would welcome conversation amongst the other board members to recognize that we have heard something different here, but maybe we could contemplate that as we have our briefing on the next topic and debate that. Yes, Dave.
Thank you. The thought occurred to me that you know, we were kind of in this same situation last month relative to the state rules versus administrative options. And what I'm wondering is, I'll just throw this out there because we seem to be kind of at a standstill right now, but you know, potentially it could, what Fish and Wildlife Service is asking could result in a rule or some kind of administrative action. And maybe there are administrative options that could be explored that would maybe get them comfortable with where they think they need to be without another rule. So I would just throw that out there for consideration.
Thank you. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
So our next item on our agenda is the critical habitat rulemaking. Sherry? Good morning, Sherry.
Good morning, Chair, members of the board. My name is Sherry Felix. I'm a policy analyst for the Forest Practices Division, and I was thinking it would be my pleasure today to move this into rulemaking, and I guess it still is, because that's not up to me, it's up to you. So I'm here to ask for your approval to move the critical habitat rule proposal into the CR 102 stage, which is review and comment by the public plus hearings. And the rule proposal makes the board's rule consistent with a number of actions that have been taken at the federal and the state level. The United States Fish and Wildlife Service removed the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon from the federal list of endangered and threatened wildlife. The Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission has removed the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon from the state threatened and endangered species lists. The Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission also removes a state requirement for a bald eagle site management plan unless the bald eagle is listed under state law as threatened or endangered. And three North American scientific societies that deal with amphibian and reptile issues have changed the common name and the scientific name of the Western Palm Turtle. So at your last meeting, you directed staff to initiate the 30-day review required by the Forest Practices Act, and we sent that rule language to counties, tribes, and somebody else. Fish and Wildlife.
Who would that be?
Too much coffee or not enough. You received one comment, and that was by the Department of Fish and Wildlife in support of the rule language as proposed. So the rule language that you have before you today in your board packet has not changed from that 30-day rule language proposal. And as far as I know, staff is not recommending any changes at this point in time.
Thank you.
Okay. So if you decide to initiate the public review of your proposed critical habitat rulemaking, Staff will file the CR 102 with the Code Advisor's Office, along with a small business economic impact statement, which is part of the preliminary economic analysis in your board packet, and conduct CEPA review and schedule hearings to coincide with the hearings for your rulemaking on notice of forest practices to affected Indian tribes. So at this point, I'm happy to answer any questions I can.
Questions for Sherry? Okay, thank you.
Okay, so now I ask for your approval to move this into public review.
Yes. So I believe that we have a motion to that effect. And we can put the motion on and have the discussion. Would anybody like to pronounce yes or no?
Oh, I will move that the Forest Practices Board approve for public review the draft rule proposal amending WAC 222-16-080 critical habitat state of threatened and endangered species. These changes will reflect the downlisting and delisting of the bald eagle and the peregrine falcon, respectively, and the name change of the western pond turtle by the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Commission. I further move the board direct staff to file a CR 102 with the Office of the Code Advisor to initiate permanent rulemaking.
Second.
Okay. Seconded by Tom. Yeah. Board discussion. Yes, Anna.
If the board's willing to still consider moving forward with this, that would be my recommendation. That still accords with action that Fish and Wildlife Commission took, and I think it's still warranted. However, I think David Whipple's suggestion actually might be worth considering that we would again be willing to commit to convening the wildlife work group and interacting especially closely with Jim Michaels, other federal staff, to look at whether there's other administrative options that we could look at to make sure that we're not jeopardizing HCP in any way, or if further rule action is required. But I would urge us to move forward with this rulemaking today.
Thank you for that. Others? North?
Well, and thank you for that, Anna. I appreciate it. The other comment I would make is that there are a host of federal rules and regulations out there that are nowhere explicitly referred to in our forest practices rules, yet we still have to follow them all. So by not including it specifically in this, I don't think it puts us in any jeopardy any more than any other omission, if that is the case. It still is our obligation as landowners, as operators, as reviewers and approvers of FPAs to follow all the laws. So I think that we have coverage there without making this explicit. I certainly support continued efforts to find an administrative solution.
Others? Yes, Tom.
I just have a suggested edit, and that is to drop the Department of, so it would just be the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission.
Oh, yes. That is true.
Excuse me, but you're with the Department of Agriculture. But thank you for that clarity, so that it is the appropriate entity is cited. The Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission is not a separate department. Thank you for that. Okay. Other discussion on the motion? Call for a vote. All those in favor of the motion as read, say aye.
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 All those opposed, say no. That's unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Sherry. Appreciate you bringing that to us today. And we will continue the administrative conversation and try to address whatever concerns might
report
remain.
Back at the next.
And we'll ask for a report back at the next meeting. Yes. Great. Okay.
And I will be killed by David.
And with that, we are at our lunch recess, or a few minutes early. We are breaking a little bit earlier today, but we are scheduled to reconvene at 12:30. We'll keep that at 12:30 and note that we have a public comment period set to begin right when we re-adjourn, and the sign-up sheet is over there, so the board is break for lunch.